This hour's top stories. Fresh Saudi airstrikes on the Yemeni capital leaves at least one person dead. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says she wants to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. And Russia registers another record in its daily coronavirus infections that raise total cases there to over 2.2 million. Welcome to the program. Saudi Arabia has carried out a series of airstrikes on Yemen. The attacks targeted the capital, Sana'a, killing at least one civilian and injuring another. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Millions more have been displaced as well. The conflict has caused a dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, with the UN calling it the worst crisis in the world. Okay, let's try to get you some update on that story and probably, you know, paint you a better picture of what is going on inside Yemen right now following that airstrike through Abdul Latif al-Washali. He's our man in Sana'a. Thank you very much to join us, Abdul Latif. Tell us what you know about this.
It's been an escalating by the Saudi coalition. We think it's because of the likely to be falling in the hands of the Yemeni army, the city of Marib. There has been about three strikes on Attan mountain, which has caused the death of a citizen, and another one was wounded. It's been three other airstrikes on the military college, which has caused the death of a number of horses in the horse barn. The damages of houses and properties of citizens is something held in these airstrikes. Tens of other airstrikes was shelled and waged on the Amran city and Saada city, and there's been also in Al-Hudaydah city, which is a breach for the Stockholm Agreement.
And how are the people handling this? What's the feeling towards Saudi Arabia? And perhaps maybe you can also tell us about how they are keeping their spirits in this situation.
Children and women has been frightened today in the morning because, you know, it's today, it's a Friday, it's a holiday. So it's people know that Marib city is about to be released and freed by the Yemeni army, and we realize that this escalating is because of that.
Abdul Latif al-Washali in Sana'a, thank you. Supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have filled the streets of Baghdad to voice support for him ahead of the country's parliamentary elections. The supporters held signs and waved the Iraqi flags to show support for the Sadr movement. Muqtada al-Sadr has said his party will participate in parliamentary elections slated for June of next year. The Sadr movement is seeking to gain a majority. According to a new Iraqi law, a party with a majority of seats in parliament can form a new government. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees announces that it is hit by an unprecedented financial crisis.
For the first time in the history of the agency, we have no cash available anymore to cover our spending between now and the end of the year.
Philip Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, says the agency has received the lowest level of contribution since 2012. This is while the coronavirus pandemic is exacerbating the needs of the refugees. The agency relies on funds from UN member states and the European Union, but its finances have been ravaged by a U.S. decision to slash hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. Lazzarini also warns that the health system in Gaza is about to collapse due to the coronavirus pandemic. Gaza, which has been under an Israeli-enforced blockade since 2007, is experiencing a deteriorating economic situation. Political commentator Zafar Bangash says U.S. projected winner by media count, Joe Biden, is unlikely to help UNRWA deal with its severe financial crisis, as he has proven to be a believing Zionist.
The Palestinians are now basically being abandoned, and they are being told that unless and until they accept the demands that the Trump regime had imposed, as well as the Netanyahu regime had imposed, that unless and until these Palestinians accept those demands, that they are going to be abandoned completely and they are going to starve in the refugee camps. So this is the stark situation that the Palestinian people face at the present time. And so what Joe Biden is going to do, we really don't know. I think we shouldn't hold too much hope, because Joe Biden is on record as stating that he is a Zionist, and he had said that if Israel did not exist, that America would have had to invent it or create it. So I think it would be unrealistic to hold too much hope that Joe Biden is going to take any steps that is somehow going to, he's going to do something that would benefit or help the Palestinian people.
The release of a Palestinian hunger striker this week has been described as an encouragement for those who are struggling against Israel's notorious detention policy in the occupied territories. Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras believes his protest action has been successful.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Akhras says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat ad-Daher in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Akhras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British Mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 1948. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped, and taken back inside for another six-month period.
Well over 300 Palestinians, including two minors, were held in Israeli jails without charge or trial as of August. For those who are held under this policy, there is no possibility of appeal or even knowing what accusations are brought against them. Israeli forces in the occupied territories can practically detain anyone and hold them indefinitely. As the health condition of Mr. al-Akhras worsened over the past few weeks, calls grew on Israel to release him and other administrative detainees. But as always, Israel remains defiant. The regime has also refused to take measures to improve the extremely poor conditions in its jails.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around one-fifth of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor prison conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
British media say Scotland's First Minister is seeking to hold a second independence referendum as soon as next year. Nicola Sturgeon has said she anticipates the vote will take place in the earlier part of the next Scottish Parliament. The term begins next year. Scotland held its first referendum on independence from Britain back in 2014. 55% of voters said no. But 14 recent polls have shown a majority of Scots now support independence. Such sentiment has gained momentum following Britain's exit from the European Union. Widespread criticism over the British government's handling of the pandemic is contributed to. London is against a new referendum in the near future. It says the previous vote should be respected. The grim news of COVID-19. Germany's total confirmed coronavirus infections has passed 1 million. Cases jumped after the Robert Koch Institute on Friday reported more than 22,000 new infections. The virus surge in the past few weeks has prompted Germany to extend a partial lockdown into January. Also on Friday, Russia registered a record high of more than 27,500 new cases. That pushes the country's total tally to over 2.2 million. Russia's death toll is nearing 39,000. In Ukraine, a record number of more than 16,000 daily cases were registered Friday. Ukraine's total infections now stand at nearly 694,000. Overall deaths are almost 12,000 there. Earlier I spoke to our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortonova, about the sharp increase in daily coronavirus cases in Russia.
So Moscow remains the leader in terms of the number of new cases. Over the past day, 7,918 cases were found here. In second place is St. Petersburg with half the figure. On November 26, Moscow authorities once again extended restrictive measures in Moscow in connection with the epidemic, and this time until mid of January, January 15, until the end of New Year holidays. So COVID hysteria forced tens of thousands of beds across the country to be registered, and a total of almost 500,000 health workers, doctors and nurses sent to the red zones.
Turkey has condemned an EU call for sanctions against Ankara over President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's recent visit to northern Cyprus. Ankara has accused the EU of being prejudiced and disconnected from the realities on Cyprus. On Thursday, the European Parliament agreed a non-binding resolution that urges tough sanctions on Ankara. Earlier this month, the president of Turkey visited northern Cyprus. That's a breakaway Turkish Cypriot state in north of Cyprus. Only Ankara recognizes northern Cyprus as an independent state 46 years after Cyprus was divided. During the trip, Erdogan said there should be talks for a solution on the basis of two separate states. Now, U.S. President Donald Trump says that he will leave the White House if the Electoral College votes for his rival, Joe Biden, to be the winner of the disputed election.
So if the Electoral College does elect President-elect Joe Biden, are you not going to leave this building?
Just so you, certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that. But I think that there will be a lot of things happening between now and the 20th of January. A lot of things.
Made the comments after a Thanksgiving Day address to U.S. troops at the White House. This was the closest the U.S. president has come to conceding defeat in the November the 3rd election. U.S. media declared Mr. Biden the winner of the election after projecting that he will receive 270 electoral votes required to enter the White House. Trump and some of his fellow Republicans claimed that the vote was rigged in favor of Biden and have filed several lawsuits to overrule the election results. The Electoral College is due to vote on December the 14th to officially decide the outcome of the presidential vote. Journalist and commentator Max Perry believes the power struggle in the U.S. is far from over, as President Trump has not yet exhausted all his options to override the election results.
In addition to this statement, he also said that a lot was going to happen in between now and January 20th. So, in my view, that could mean that he may be considering other legal avenues, including possibly trying to order the state legislatures, where there's a Republican majority in both houses in these contested states, to override the popular vote and elect pro-Trump electors to the Electoral College instead. I'm not so sure myself that this power struggle is over, that all of his avenues have been exhausted, and that could mean, as I said, trying to override the popular vote and get these state legislators to appoint pro-Trump electors, or taking it to the Supreme Court, which his campaign lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, seems dead set on doing.
Lawyers for the detained Huawei top executive have accused Canadian police of covering up the illegal sharing of data with the United States. Lawyers said the Canadian police sent private information from Meng Wanzhou's electronic devices to the FBI during her arrest 2 years ago. They said the top Canadian law enforcement officer overseeing the arrest tried to cover up for her colleagues. Sergeant Janice Vandergraff said Meng's information had not been sent. This is while Graff previously wrote in her notes that a colleague said it had been. The Huawei top executive was held on a U.S. warrant during a Vancouver stopover in December of 2018. She has been fighting extradition to the U.S., where she faced fraud and conspiracy charges. China says her detention is politically motivated. In Europe, three French police officers have been suspended after they were filmed beating and allegedly racially abusing a black man in Paris. That's according to France's police watchdog. While the body says an official inquiry is also underway into the officer's behavior, the victim is a music producer. He said that he had been walking around without a face mask and walked into his studio. However, the police followed him inside and physically attacked him using tear gas. The case comes as anger is boiling in France over a new security law approved on Tuesday. The law places restrictions on identifying police officers involved in operations. Critics say the legislation would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. The enemy perfectly understands the significance of unity among Islamic denomination, and hence it hatches plots to prevent it.
It was the enemies of Islam who created that lethal group called Daesh. However, the Americans themselves acknowledged it. Certain individuals in the administration that had created Daesh acknowledged it, and also in the subsequent administration, the person who is now in charge, that is Donald Trump, explicitly said that it was they who created and who supported Daesh. They ordered their mercenaries in the region, the governments that follow their orders, to pay Daesh money, and they bought weapons for them, as well as giving them all kinds of equipment and ammunitions. This is one of the things that they did. Therefore, they created centers for producing thoughts. They created terrorist orientations, and they did something to involve the elements who were well informed or who did not want to enter into this game. They made them angry, and they provoked them into insulting one another.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
For example, you witness that in such and such a neighboring country, someone takes the minbar and begins to insult the holy beliefs of another denomination, and after he steps down the minbar, he goes and seeks asylum in an English embassy. This is what has happened, which is a recent development. There are many such examples. They provoke certain individuals to enrage people and audiences and to pit them against one another. Well, they have explicitly said that they have done these things. However, what I want to say is that those regional governments who have undertaken the effort to provide financial support to these groups are more to blame than the individuals who have joined such groups. In other words, those who leave home for such and such a part of the world of Islam based on their religious zeal and ignorance to join such terrorist groups are less to blame than the chief politician and king who pays and organizes them and who provides them with weapons. Of course, the main crime has been committed by the Americans. This is really the case.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
face to face. Dear listeners, what you hear now is an interview with Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh about ongoing developments in that country.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me. It's been 2 years since the Sudanese revolution, since the protests began. What do you think has been the main challenges, and have people's lives significantly changed since the revolution?
I think that the transition itself, it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge for the government, for the Sovereign Council, and for the political parties. And if we study the experience of transitional period in many countries, it always been very difficult time with a lot of challenges and obstacles. And we face the same challenges and obstacles here in Sudan. It was difficult even to change the mentality of the people, the ordinary people, the people in the civil service, in the governments, who used to be under dictatorship for military and dictatorship for 30 years. And at the same time, we have the problems of also changes in the military side, in the security, in the police department, in the army, which they are now partners. So all these were the difficulties we are facing. Some of them are expected already. We expect to have such problems. Some of them are new ones. At the beginning of the revolution and before that, people were hoping that we are going to have a full civilian transitional government and transitional organs. No one expected such situation of multiple military and civilian. So this is a new challenge. We found ourselves in a position where the civilian are negotiating with the army and they should be both on board. We were not prepared for that. The political parties were not prepared for that. The FFC, when she led the revolution, were not prepared for that. So this was a de facto situation that you have to deal with it. So this has also created new problems. Since this government came, we are trying to deal with these difficulties and challenges. I think we have been successful in some of them, especially, for example, in the side of peace agreement. It was a success, although, of course, some of the armed movement are still out of this peace negotiation. We hope that they are going to join. And the main challenges, I think, was economic one. And I will say, frankly, we were not successful in that. We still have a lot of problems. We knew from the beginning that we are going to have a very difficult economy, the old regime. And we had some ideas that we are going to overcome this problem. Unfortunately, and again, frankly, I will say that we were not successful in overcoming this problem. We're still suffering. Part of it, I think, will be solved because of the lifting of the American sanctions. Part of it, not all of it. But at least it will open doors for investment. It will open door for Sudan to rejoin the international banking system, which is one of the problems we are facing. But this is now is the main challenge, that the economic one.
And something you mentioned was you did not anticipate joining the military. You was expecting a full civilian government.
Yes.
What happened? How have we got to this situation where we have this kind of partnership between the military and the civilian government?
What happened is that simply, that the army intervened when they knew that the revolution will continue. And I think they have reached to the point where they think that the old regime cannot continue. And maybe they were thinking of if a new regime came, then there will be some negative aspects, negative result on the army, so they decided to intervene. So it appeared at the beginning that they are intervening in favor of the civilians, the protesters. But of course, when they did that, they asked for a share of power. And I think this is expected and natural in such situations. We have the same experience in 1985. We also, the army intervened in the last moment, and so they were part of the transitional government. It lasted only for 1 year, but this time here is 4 years. So I think when they intervened, when they took the power and they ousted the old regime, then the civilian FFC found themselves in a situation where they have to negotiate. And there came the intermediate, the African Union intervened, Ethiopia intervened, the mediators came in, and it was a situation, as I said, it's a de facto situation where you have to negotiate with the army. And it was from that day, 11th of April 2019, people expected that the army will be on board with the civilian. The negotiation was what's the share of the army will be and what's the share of the civilians. And I think because of the balance of power, by that time we reached to this result. Again, maybe it was not anticipated, it was not the same, the type of civilian transition government that people were expected, but this is how things went. And so it started from August 2019, this civilian and military partnership.
And it's a process, the transitional period is a process, and at the end of the process, the hope and the aim is for a democratically elected government.
Yes.
But what's to say the army doesn't do the same thing again, and they once again try to share power with a democratically elected government?
I think that will depend on the balance of power. Because we had this, what we call constitutional declaration, and the constitutional declarations put an end to the military participation by the end of the transitional period, where we should finish the constitution, the new constitution, and we are going to have an election, and of course a new democratic government will take control. And the army will go back to the barracks, will be just doing what the army in the other countries do. This is what the constitutional declaration and the political agreement agreed upon. And I think everything depends on this balance of power, because if the civilians are weak, then maybe the army will have a new ideas. But day after day, there is a progress on that.
And we've traveled to many places on our trips, and one of the places we went to is Mayo, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Khartoum. It seems like the economically disenfranchised, which seems to be getting larger, it seems to be growing. What message can the Transitional Council give to them about economic prosperity in the future, or at least uplifting them from the economic situation that they're in?
That is linked to two issues. One of them is political and the other one is economic. Political one is peace. Most of the people who are living in these areas came from the war-affected areas, and they are live in the margins of the big cities, and also they don't have, some of them, most of them don't have skill, they were not educated, so they are doing marginal jobs. And I think if we successful enough in implementing the peace agreement, most of these people will go back to their areas, where they are farmers or whatever the profession they have, and they resettle in their own areas where they have at least some peace and stability. That I think will improve the economic situation of them, because as I said, they will not be in the margin of their own life. They will be in the center of the life they are used to do to live in the past. So this is the political side, that if we have enough peace and stability and security in the war-affected area, people will go back to these areas and live ordinary life. The other side is the economic one. As I said, we were not successful in that till now, because we promised people of working on sustainable development, and that we are trying to find way where the people will at least find education, health care, without spending a lot of money on that. That would be the government responsibility. And we still, although we promise to start from day one to do that, we didn't fulfill this for them. Because I think most of the problem they have is with education and health care. They are spending a lot of money on that, although they don't have enough money to do that. So this is part of the program the government promised to do, to work on it, free education for all people of Sudan, and free basic health care. And that, as I said, because we were not successful in pulling the country from this economic crisis, we still couldn't do that. I think, as I said again, when with this lifting sanctions, the American sanction on Sudan, now we will be open for receiving help and fund from international finance institution that will help improving the country. Also, I think we are going to receive a lot of investment. Sudan is rich with its resources, natural resources, that will open door for investors. And rejoining the international banking system will also attract investors. I think with new investments, that will help improving the situation in the country and will improve the situation in these war-affected areas and the marginal areas.
So you mentioned the delisting of Sudan from the state sponsor of terror. Many international observers say that that had less to do with the compensation offered to American victims of terror and more to do with Sudan agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. What was your response?
At the beginning, that was not the case. We have started from day one. In September 2019, the negotiation with the Americans on the political and legal side of the this case of delisting Sudan from state sponsoring terrorism and the compensation for the families of the victims of terrorist act that Sudan, the old Sudan government was linked to. And the issue of normalizing relationship with Israel was never, by that time, was never mentioned. We started, as I said, in September 2019. So the negotiation went on the political side with the American administration and with the victims' families, the legal side. And that went on for maybe 7 or 8 months. And it went on successfully until we reached the point where we reduce the amount of money that the Sudan government will pay for the as a compensation for the victims' families. In the last few months, and then the question of normalization with Israel was raised. And what was not raised only with Sudan, as you may see, with Emirates, with Bahrain, with other countries. And we insisted on two things, that separation of the two issues. We used to say to them, and that was said to Secretary of State Bami when he came to Sudan, that these are two separate issues. Delisting Sudan from SST, we are negotiating on that in 7 or 8 months. Normalization with Israel is a very controversial issue. It could be discussed, of course. There's no problem in that, in discussing it in Sudanese media or discussion with the public, whatever it is. It could be discussed. But separated from the delisting of Sudan from SST, this is number one. Number two, Our response to him was that we are a transitional government. This issue is not one of our mandate. And that is what we agreed upon in the civilian government with the FFC. We had a joint meeting before a day before he came, and we agreed that this is not a part of our mandate as a transitional government. This should be left to an elected government to discuss it. Then the American pressure on Sudan started. Until that time, he didn't say that it was linked, the delisting with the normalization. But he used to raise the issues. Until maybe the last 2 weeks before the American election. And I think Sudan was used as a card in the elections. Trump want to have some cards in his favor. Part of it, is convincing some Arab countries to normalizing relationship with Israel. So it was linked directly. Sudan was put under a very heavy pressure. In the last week, it was said clearly, this is linked. If you want Sudan to be listed, delisted from the SST, then you have to normalize your relationship with Israel. It was a very difficult situation. And the economic expert, our economics expert, our economic minister said that Sudan cannot tolerate the sanction for 7 or 2 months after election. If we said no, then we will wait for the election, then the new administration will have 6, 7, 8 months until they have done all the heavy duty that they are supposed to do, the homework, until they can discuss things with Sudan. This is a very long time Sudan cannot tolerate. So the government had to do that, had to promise that they are going to normalize the relationship with Israel, but there was one condition. The whole issue will go to the Legislative Council. The Legislative Council is supposed to be established in a few weeks, that the whole issue of normalizing the relationship with Israel will go to the Legislative Council. If it is approved by the Legislative Council, then the formal step will start. So that was the agreement until the election. We all watched what happened in the American election. And now I think that the issue of delisting will go on because the Democrats in the Congress approved it before even the election. So there was no problem in delisting Sudan from that. We are confident that this issue will go on successfully. The only issue still left is Sudan should be given some type of immunity from future cases, because paying compensation to these families may be that it will open door for some other families. And some of the senators have raised the issue of September 11 victims. They said that some of the families want also to sue Sudan. So this will be something that endless process. And we have said many times, even in the agreement, when we signed the agreement to pay the compensation for the families of Sudan, actually Sudanese people have nothing to do with terrorism. And that was an act of an ousted government. And it is not fair that Sudanese people should continue paying the price of that, for that. Because the old regime hurt Sudanese people more than they hurt the American or the people of other countries. So we shouldn't pay the price twice. We have paid the price for 30 years. And now there is a new democratic government. It is suffering to try to take the country in the transitional process. It should be helped by the whole world and by the American administration not to be punished for crime committed by the old regime. We hope that the new administration will be open. We are also optimistic that the new administration will consider that. At least the Democrats say that they are more concerned with the democracy and human rights in the world. And I think if they want to present Sudan as a model for the region, they should help Sudan improving the situation of human rights and democracy. And that, of course, will be one of the conditions if you want to promote democracy in the region, to help the new democratic regime like Sudan.
And do you think the economic situation, the long queues for bread, for fuel, do you think that was used by the Americans as a negotiation tactic to force Sudan to normalize relations?
I cannot say that directly, but at least they didn't help Sudan to overcome such problems. It was not created by the Americans. Maybe they are not used directly, but at least the Sudan was not helped in trying to overcome these economic problems.
And one of the issues that has come up is accountability. One of the most infamous parts of the revolution was the June the 3rd massacre. Yet when I've spoken to different people, they have very little hope that there'll ever be accountability for those that ordered the killings. What would you say to those people?
We are working hard on that. It's a very difficult task. Very, very difficult task. We have formed an independent committee to investigate what happened on the 3rd of June, and it's working with difficulties. And they have asked for extension for their... They were given 3 months, and then they asked for extension for 3 months, and now we are in the third extension of the 3 months. They are complaining of that. They have almost about 3,000 witnesses. They have listened to 3,000 witnesses. They have hundreds of videotapes that they are looking and try to verify. And the task is very difficult. They are facing a very difficult time. They are working in a very difficult situation, and we understand that. And we try to explain that to the people. It is not an easy task. It needs some time. We should give them the time they ask for, so that when they finish their reports, the reports will be convincing reports. So they have to spend the time they ask for. This is one thing. But in other cases, there is now ongoing trials on some of the martyrs of the revolution. Said that there is now about 5 trials going on. In Al-Ubayyid, and here in Khartoum, in Al-Hasahisa. Those are people killed during the revolution. And fortunately, at least the people who committed the crime were identified. And this is one of the problems. Many people killed, and you cannot identify who did that. But on those cases where the people are identified, they are now on trials. It is maybe a slow process, but I think this is the type of justice we want to do. We want a full trial. We want the ordinary judicial system to do that. We didn't have a special court for such things as the old regime used to do. And we give full right to those accused to have lawyers, to have time for the lawyers to examine the case. So this is how justice is done. I know it is sometimes slow, and maybe the people don't like that. They want to find a very fast trial, but I think fast trial will not be a just trial. A bit patient for justice to be done. At the same time, people want to cooperate, because you know, in many cases that is on trial, the court sometimes they don't have enough evidence. So we call on people who have some information to come and appear on this course and to give their information that they have. Maybe it is slow, we know that. Also, one of the problems, we have problems with the Attorney General office. He's always complaining of not having enough people to work with them. We have people with the judicial, we have problems with the judicial system, which also inherited from the old regime. But we are working hard to deal with these problems.
And my final question, those that look at what's going on in Sudan argue that Sudan is being influenced by regional actors. Sudan plays a pivotal role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and there's clearly Saudi and Emirati influence within the military council. How does Sudan chart an independent foreign policy while these regional actors have such vested interest in the Republic of Sudan?
That's true. I mean, part of this situation was inherited. For example, the involvement of Sudanese army in Yemen was inherited from the old regime, and we are trying to find a way to finish that. We are concerned with what happened in Yemen. We are also concerned what's happening in Saudi Arabia. But involving directly in a war is not the right thing to do, and to help the situation to be solve the crisis in Yemen. We have a very long relationship with Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, we don't think sending army is the right way to help Saudi or Saudi Arabia or to help Yemen. So we are trying to deal with such situation, at least to reach a point where we can pull the Sudanese army from Yemen and try to play a positive role in solving the crisis in Yemen. And you know what's happening in Libya, what's happening in South Sudan, what is happening now in Ethiopia. We are living in a very difficult areas in the world, very difficult situation where the countries around Sudan have a lot of problems. And that puts Sudan within different axes. From day one, we say that we want Sudan to be independent and we to have independent foreign policies. But also that cannot happen in a moment. We are aware of that. We are aware that Sudan is considered part of this Saudi Emirates axe. We want Sudan to be very independent in its foreign policy and having a normal relationship with all countries. And now I think the relationship with Qatar has improved a bit, and we hope that we are going to improve it more so we can have the normal relationship with all countries. But one of the main thing people of Sudan ask for is this foreign independent foreign policy. And I think during the transition we are moving, maybe slowly, but we are moving towards that.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality. Back to
Reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. With me today are two lovely brothers. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. This is Mohsen Naqvi. Thanks for inviting.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Daro from US. Thank you.
So, the topic that we have for today is how can violence against girls and women be stopped? You know, as we know today, there is a lot of violence against women in this world. You know, they're being beaten up either by their husbands, sometimes it's at their workplace, or in general in society, we see a lot of violence against women. What's the way? What can we do to stop this?
This is a very interesting question. You know why? Because like, for example, you see like violence against children, violence against workers, employees. Mm-hmm. So employer to employees. And then like, you see all these pressures that mm-hmm. comes from different, you know, different topics, different sects, group of people.
Yeah.
From this religion to that religion, for example, this tribe to that tribe. I find that very interesting that all this thing has to do with the justice and adl of the human being and human society and individual. It has to do with the character. It doesn't have to do with the gender, being a male or female. This question by itself can be misguiding by itself.
Wouldn't you say that as men, we don't really get that
but
much beaten up?
It's not necessarily the man. Yeah. Violating the girls or the women.
Yeah, it could be. There are some societies, the woman abuses the man. So this question, yeah, you might be seen more because it's more apparent. Because, yeah. Oh, this guy is hitting his wife, or this guy is abusing this lady, this girl. We have this thing through the history. This is the nature of human to abuse and put the pressure on the weak.
Right.
So, you know, even the Islam, when it came to protect the female, it came to protect the woman. You know, it raised the woman's status in the society and the culture. So That's how you, one of the way I think you can distinguish between the right and wrong.
Sure, but the question is, you know, how do we prevent these crimes from happening, right? How do we prevent this violence? And I would say...
The question is, can I prevent it individually? Can I prevent it in my home? Can I prevent it in my city? Can I prevent it in my country? Can I prevent it in the whole society? It's just like, there's no answer. It's like, you have to know your capabilities.
So one example that I can give is how, for example, some things are being prevented in society, right? Is that, let's take the coronavirus right now, right? There is so much awareness about coronavirus, right? About wearing a mask, about people being shamed for not wearing a mask, right? Wouldn't you say, and I'll ask both of you, can this not be done for these type of crimes? About why? Can we not raise awareness? You know, can people not be trained by the media like it is?
No.
Why not?
Cannot be trained because it's about the jihad al-nafs. It's about the individual character. You have to work on your character as an individual. Human beings are not coronas. Each individual, each female and male are different. Yeah. They have different identities. They have different characters. They have different backgrounds. So, what am I standing like? How can you really? It is, that's what we have, a bad and good in this world.
Yeah, I'll give you a chance to respond.
Well, I think when we talk about the stopping the violence against the girls and the women, or maybe the other parts of the society, or the entities of the society, first we need to look at the reasons. Why is this happening?
Yep.
And if we can stop those reasons from happening, the violence will stop automatically. That's the first thing.
Right.
Giving awareness is a good thing. But the point is how we need to stop these things. And obviously, there are different ways. There is a role of a media into this. And the major thing that I can see, the major part or the main reason behind this violence is media itself.
Yeah, how do you blame the media for this?
There are two things. Number one, the news part. You know, in today's world, we see a lot of news regarding these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you give the news, the more things are coming up. The more fear is amongst the people. Obviously, when you talk about something, it comes into your mind. It saves in a part of your mind. And then tomorrow, if someone is weak and he does not have a strong heart, or he cannot control his wishes or desires, he will go towards that. And this is a fact that the human beings are weak. That's the first thing. The second thing is the media has made everything easy. For example, pornography is there. Mm-hmm. For example, the movies that they are making, why they're showing the love of, for example, the two couples into the movies.
Mm-hmm.
When you're portraying, when you're showing everything on the TV box, which is in the house, in which the brother, sisters, father, mother, the parents, they all are sitting next to each other and they're watching a movie, and then they're just watching it as a normal thing. They see it as a normal thing. It's not something extraordinary or maybe unusual for them.
Yeah.
When it does not look for them, then obviously tomorrow these kids gonna go and try the same thing.
But that's my point, though, right? That you're saying the media is teaching people, right?
Yes.
And I'm saying that's what I'm saying. The same media can be used to teach people.
Yes, it is. No, the first thing is you need to stop these things first. Obviously, you know, when someone becomes sick, first you cure. Mm-hmm. First you, because for example, if I have a sugar and I eat a lot of medicines to control my sugar, but on the other hand, I do not stop eating sugar or taking the sweet things or sweets, I cannot be cured. First, I need to stop taking the sweets first. The main thing is you need to identify the reasons why this violence is happening so much.
Mm-hmm.
And why is this happening? You need to stop those things first and then give the awareness. And then there is a role of government, obviously,
mm-hmm.
that they should give the awareness through the, I don't know, the council, the society, you can say the halls or the churches or the mosques and all those. So even the schools, the teachers, they can give the awareness. Today we have this issue that even in the school we have such educations, whereas they should be separated. Obviously, if you separate the girls' class from the boys' class and